There are a number of mountain systems that snake their way into the suburban edges of my hometown in the Pacific Northwest. One particularly large system was owned by a private logging company. No trespassing signs abounded, but it was nevertheless covered with world-class mountain biking trails, and word on the street was that we could simply ignore those signs. One day as I rode up my favorite trail, I was horrified to find an enormous new clear cut right through a favorite section of evergreens. Even though I understood it was private property, I was heartbroken. Imagine how worse it stings when people happen upon trees missing from their favorite forest spots on public lands where they're supposed to be managed or protected. Sadly, tree poaching is a thing. Welcome to Riding Westward. I'm your host, Brennan Rensink. This month, we address this sad topic with author and journalist Lindsay Borgon and her book, Tree Thieves: Crime and Survival in North America's Woods. Thanks for listening. For new listeners, allow me to take a moment to explain a bit about Riding Westward and myself. Each episode features a conversation with people writing about the North American West, historians, journalists, novelists, poets, scientists, sociologists, and others. By showcasing their work, I hope to spark your curiosity to think more deeply about the region, its lands and environments, and the histories and experiences of the peoples who call it home. If a writer or topic intrigues you, you can find links to their work in the show notes or at writingwestward.org. And if you have a moment, please do subscribe, share links with friends, leave us a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you're using to listen, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and send in some feedback. Riding Westward is supported by the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at Brigham Young University, where I, Brennan Rensink, serve as Associate Director and an Associate Professor of History. For better or worse, this is a one-man operation, with me playing role of host, producer, sound engineer, publicist, and everything else, all tasks for which I have no training. But I am passionate about the North American West, so this difficult work is well worth the excuse to read more books and talk to interesting people. At the end of each episode, I'll include a little bit more information about me and my scholarship and about the Redd Center, our public programming and projects and funding opportunities that you could apply for. With that, let me introduce a little bit more about today's guest and why we're talking to them. Lindsay Borgon is a journalist, author, oral historian, fellow of the Royal Canadian Geographical Society, and National Geographic Explorer, who looks at the intersections of the environment, history, culture, identity, and more. She holds a Bachelor of Journalism degree from University of King's College in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and a Master's in Environmental History from the University of St. Andrew in Scotland. She has published stories in an impressively diverse set of venues, including the National Geographic Magazine, Smithsonian Magazine, The Atlantic, The Walrus, The Guardian, and others, many of which were winners of or finalists for awards and honors. Her recent book, Tree Thieves: Crime and Survival in North America's Woods, was published by Little Brown Spark in 2022. It was longlisted for the PEN America Kenneth R. Galbraith Award for Nonfiction, shortlisted for the Columbia University and Nieman Foundation J. Anthony Lucas Award, a finalist for the 2022 Banff Mountain Book Competition Environmental Literature Award, an honorable mention for the Society of Environmental Journalists Rachel Carson Environment Book Award, and a finalist for the BC and Yukon Book Prizes Hubert Evans Nonfiction Award. In Tree Thieves, Borgon opens up the world of historic and contemporary tree poaching in the Pacific Northwest. It may surprise some that stealing trees is even a thing, and it will likely shock all that it is in fact annually a multi-billion dollar industry. Moving beyond a simple narration of the cat-and-mouse dynamics between poachers, land managers, and law enforcement, Borgon spent considerable time in these places to build relationships with people and understand them. This serves her purpose of trying to tease out the historic, social, economic, and cultural contexts for why tree poaching is so prevalent in the region. It is compelling work, filled with intimate, on-the-ground stories, and intersecting them with macro-level context. Borgon reveals dynamics between locals, outsiders, government employees, the lumber industries, and others that resonate strongly with situations all across the rural West. So whether you live in an area of the West where tree poaching may be a thing or not, you will find great value in her work. both in terms of her approach and methods, as well as the conclusions she makes. I was left especially convinced that this book demonstrates the power of and need for dialogue and empathy. There is no shortage of contests in the West over controlling resources, but productive discourse on solving them is rare. In Tree Thieves, Orgon's work shows us a path forward. Lindsay Borgon, welcome to Writing Westward.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
I'm really excited to talk about your book. I was just looking at some of your bio info on your website, though, and I am tempted to just to spend a whole hour talking about the year you spent living in an off-grid beachside cabin on Haida Gwaii. We probably should talk about
it. It was closer to 8 months, so not a full year, but through the winter.
So close enough, though. That sounds like an absolute dream.
It was. I learned a lot about hauling water and how often you need to do it. But it was a beautiful place. Yeah,
these are important life skills.
They are. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about your relationship to the West as a region or as an identity?
Sure. This is quite a loaded question for me. So thank you for asking. I was born in Calgary, Alberta, in Canada, which is perhaps most famous for its stampede, the Calgary Rodeo or the Calgary Stampede. When I was 10, my family moved further south to a really small town in southern Alberta called Milk River. And Milk River is about 20 minutes away from the Montana border. It has a population of about 800 people, and it's a ranching and farming hub in a sense. I mean, the closest city was an hour away, but, you know, there were grocery stores and a school and other sorts of services. And I grew up there, and I didn't grow up in a farming family. But we did move eventually to an acreage in this sort of prairie landscape. And I think, like a lot of teenagers who had interests in the arts and stuff like that, I just wanted to get out. And I associated the West ignorantly, but then I also say this because I was like 16, with quite a conservative mindset and something that I didn't agree with. And I just wanted to leave. And so I did. I graduated from high school, and I moved to fully across the country to go to journalism school at a small liberal arts college in Canada, which I did. And then I spent many years moving all around, working as a freelance reporter. And eventually I found my way back to Calgary when I was like 26, I think. And by that point, I think I was kind of more ready to consider what was going on in this place and in Alberta on a bit of a deeper level, because I had experienced other places. Not only that, I had experienced the way that other people reacted to me when I said where I was from. And I kind of knew all of a sudden a feeling that I hadn't known before, which was like judgment and also feeling a bit defensive, also about something that I didn't necessarily always want to be defending, but like anyway. And so when I got back, I started like covering and writing about kind of traditionally more Western things. Like I wrote a big story about the Stampede and sexism at the Stampede and what it's like being a woman for those 2 weeks every summer in Calgary, and covering mountain issues and land management issues. And this
all once very I Western. Start,
yeah. Yeah. Forest fires. I wrote about I started writing a little bit about wild horses, and then in writing about wild horses, I met this fellow who runs his own prairie church. So like a cowboy church. So I wrote about him. And so all of these issues were kind of rolling up together in my brain in a really exciting way, where I was like, oh, like I'm finally understanding something about where I grew up and these kind of compelling stories that I had been looking to tell. And suddenly there they were laid out for me.
And so then what led you to a little farther west to the Pacific Northwest into thinking about trees and forests?
Yeah. I read a very short news article about timber poaching back in 2012. Somebody had stolen a tree from Vancouver Island. And actually, so, you know, I've just kind of laid this out for you, but I grew up in a prairie setting. Like, we did not have trees unless somebody planted them around their house, right? And I knew that on the island, this is a place of iconic, huge trees, huge Douglas firs, huge cedar, all this old growth. And so I was like, what? like people steal trees? I've never heard of this before. How would they even do it? Where are they even taking it? And I started kind of looking into it. I thought at first, especially because at that point I really was a freelance journalist. And so I had a sort of different hat on, and I was like, this is going to make an amazing, really quick true crime story that I'm going to report out, and I'll follow the Rangers and get some court documents, that kind of thing. But I started calling around, and one person I spoke to was a sociologist, and she was like, this is about so much more than a crime. Like, this is about identity in these former logging towns. This is about what happened when those economies were really hollowed out. I mean, like, there is still logging in those communities, but you know, nowhere near the way it used to be. And this is trickle down effect of that. And also at the same time, I had been hearing Rangers who I really respected, and a lot of other people who I also respected, kind of be a little bit quick to say, like, tree poachers are meth heads. Like, that's why this is happening.
Like, that's the only explanation.
Yeah, just, you know, why does somebody steal trees while they're a drug addict? And so then I was like, this is much bigger. This is a huge story. I started reading into, like, the history of poaching, and I realized, oh, this is compelling in a way that is beyond what I thought it was, the reason I thought it was interesting.
Well, that's always the sign of a good story when, you know, it has an intriguing hook that makes you go dig, and then, you know, you quickly find out, oh no,
yeah,
this is going to be more than just a one-off story.
Oh yeah. And to be honest too, at the time I had a hard time sort of placing it, like selling it. It was partly because a lot of magazine editors, and I understand this completely, but they wanted a sort of shorter narrative of what I had written, you know, so like find a tree poacher, go write about them. And I felt like the amount of work it's going to take for me to go out and talk to tree poachers, it should be a book,
yeah.
You know, like, because I didn't want to develop those relationships and then have it be sort of a quick story.
Because it's going to take, I mean, doing oral history work like you do, like, it takes time sometimes, especially with groups like tree poachers. It may take a really long time, right, to
yes.
gain access and trust. And
yeah, or even, you know, actually in my case, once I started reaching out to folks, it didn't take a lot of convincing at all. It was just footwork, because a lot of folks really respond well to you being there in person.
Yeah.
So
yeah, for listeners, like, I want to rattle off a few numbers here about, because again, the idea of what people steal trees, I mean, especially, you know, you're from the prairie provinces, and like a cottonwood, why would, like, I'm trying to think, or
yes,
or smaller scrubby little trees, but you know, in the Pacific Northwest, and, you know, all the way down to Northern California and lots of other places in the world, there are trees which are worth stealing for their size or for the unique qualities of their wood. You and I'm just pulling these numbers from your book, but in the United States, you say it's about $1 billion annually is poached. About $100 million from Forest Service lands, $350 million from private lands. You estimate that one out of every 10 trees cut is poached, which is actually really mind-blowing.
Yeah, on the federal, on federal land.
On federal lands, okay.
Yes. So, yeah, that's, 10%.
That's nuts.
You know, that's, yeah, it is, yeah.
And it's part of a bigger global market, which you put at, I think, over $150 billion in trees
alone.
Yeah,
so the illegal timber trade is up there with other organized crimes, essentially.
Yeah.
So it's tracked by Interpol the same way that they would track, like, drunk smuggling. And now they actually really track a lot of plant life and the trade in other sort of species. But
wildlife has been tracked, I think. I think people are aware of, like, illicit trade and, you know, endangered species and things like that. But
exactly.
I don't think people think of trees.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time outdoors. It's kind of my main hobby. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, spending most of my time outdoors. And visually, I can't pinpoint seeing evidence of poaching. Is it concentrated in just very specific areas or in just really remote backcountry areas? Why is it that visually people may not be as aware of this as an issue?
Oh, that's a great question. So actually, the time that I spent in Redwoods National Park with the rangers there, and they took me to kind of four or five different poaching sites, only one of those required any sort of backcountry knowledge. I would posit that the reason why most of us are not noticing this is a sort of trust that if you see a stump in the forest, that tree has been cut down by the, like sort of a, you wouldn't even think about it, you know? Like, you might just walk by and think, there's a stump there. The park must have taken this tree down. Maybe it fell across the trail.
So we may see it, but we don't. We just walk right by. We don't even register that it's something to think about.
Yeah. And so, for instance, a little bit more field work that I spent in British Columbia with some resource, they call them resource officers, on the land that we were on. I was just in the front seat of this truck and they would point out things. They'd be like, oh, do you see that, like, scrape in the road with all that kind of bark and needles? And yeah. Okay. That's a poaching site, you know? And I had not looked at the world with that lens on, you know? So to me, it's kind of, I would have ignored it. I would have just thought, I don't even think I would have thought anything, you know?
I mean, that's part of the problem, right?
Yeah. And I think especially in the national park, I think.
Do we just kind of assume the best? We assume that management
that it's like
and
fully
protection
protected
is all.
And, and I mean, some of the poaching as well. So burl poaching, I remember standing on the edge of this trail, just kind of looking up at these beautiful redwoods, and the ranger saying, do you see that one in the back that has kind of, like, if you look kind of up the hill a little bit to the left, you can see that there's like a shadow on this trunk. And I said, yeah. And he was like, so that's a burl poaching site. But you could see it right from the trail, you know, but I never would have noticed that. I would have just, my eyes would have glazed over it.
That's what's always fun about going outdoors with, like, I sometimes go trail running with some wildlife and plant wildlife biologists here at the university, and they see things, they're looking through different lenses than I am, and they see things all over the landscape that I just don't even know to look at.
Especially like marks on the ground, duff, like just piles of sticks where there wouldn't normally be some, or, you know, somebody, I think I start the book, or maybe it's further on in the book. I can't remember of somebody noticing that a bunch of clover had been like upturned due to some footsteps. You could see the bottom of this clover that had like a purple tinge. And to them, that indicated that a bear had been nearby. and they were bear researchers, so they followed it. But actually, it was somebody's footsteps that led him to a poaching site. So there you go. I wouldn't have known to notice the upside down clover.
I'm also curious about the kind of this idea of, so if we assume that, you know, if it's a national park or especially like a wilderness designated area, that it's just really carefully protected, although I think people probably are generally aware of understaffing and, you know,
sure.
underfunding issues. Like there's not rangers all over the, the mountains. And so, actually in some areas, there's shockingly huge swaths of the land that have, you know, per acre, like, I mean, you have like one ranger per, I mean, I don't know how many thousands of square miles. It's, there's not a lot of people out there. But in addition, so here in Utah, a lot of the lands, it's a patchwork of Forest Service, BLM, CITLA, which is like lands that are held in trust by the school, state schools, and then revenues go to the school education system, and then private and others, some other public agencies. And where I grew up in Northwest Washington, it was more Forest Service, national parks, and private. And you write about different kind of protective layers for the forest. In your introduction, you write that they are, I'm sorry for quoting you to yourself, this is the worst. You say that they're, quote, managed on stratified bureaucratic levels that at points overlap and collaborate. But do they also then leave gaps because it's never always clear to everyone where you are in the land, what agency you're on the land? Does that create opportunity for poaching?
I think that I'm not sure if boots on the ground wise that's having an effect, but I do think communication wise it does. And I think a lot of rangers have expressed frustration to me in one way or another that there's no like central hub often for communications to know who knows about what, to know who's going to take on investigating this case because it was on this land versus 2 feet over, it would have been on a company's wood lot kind of thing. So I think on a bureaucratic level, there definitely is some, I don't know if miscommunication is the word, but challenges in that management.
It doesn't necessarily make it easier to poach, but it does hinder the law enforcement side of investigating or prosecuting. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the resourcing as well. Who's going to pay for what out of their resourcing hours?
Uh-huh.
Who has more chance of it making it to court? If this is something that you feel has a really strong chance to make it that far, you want to make sure that it's going to be effective. So who, you know, which organization is going to have the most capacity in that regard? And also on the investigation level, we could talk a little bit about this, but particularly when there are towns near a lot of these national forests and national parks and state parks, the role of a park ranger sometimes involves then going into the town. They're not town police, but they are investigating a crime that occurred on their land. So there's a little bit of cooperation that needs to happen there between sheriffs and local police and park rangers who sometimes do and sometimes don't have the authority to arrest people. And it's just, it can get complicated about who needs to be around when and who has the authority to do what. And so with all of that planning comes a lot of time. in which a poacher may or may not continue poaching or may or may not even be in the town anymore.
I also think of, you know, this seems like a situation where kind of crowdsourcing the monitoring like could be really powerful. You know, lots of people are out in the woods doing all kinds of things and playing and recreating. But so I have some in-laws, or I guess in-laws of some in-laws. I don't know what their name would be, but I'm in Northern Arizona, and they seasonally used to contract with the Forest Service to cut trees, to clear underbrush, do stuff like this, like up on like the Mogollon Rim. But, you know, they're just like dressed in civilian clothes with a pickup truck doing this work. And, you know, for someone hiking by, it wouldn't be clear, are these poachers? Are these people working for the Forest Service? And it's just not clear. So I think people just don't think about it, and they just,
you know. And you think, well, somebody must know, you know, especially at that level of, you know, if somebody's got a vehicle and all of this equipment.
Like, surely
I'm sorry to tell
to
you
this.
That plenty of poachers also have the same thing, right? So it's, it's kind of, I mean, all of those things are very interesting, right? Because they're contracting out to the, they're contracted out from the Forest Service. That's totally legit. Who's monitoring that on the ground? You know, I have no.
Well, the Forest Service definitely doesn't have the manpower to monitor, you know.
No, they don't. It's not their fault at all. You know, it's nobody's. It's certainly nobody on that level's.
Well, maybe we should talk about like why this is a thing. I mean, this is a big question your book is asking. And before we get to some of your discussion about the socioeconomic reasons, which I think you were hinting earlier was part of what convinced you that, oh, this is more than a one-off story. It's not just tweakers and, you know, meth heads that are stealing some trees to fund their next hit, you know. What are the types of trees that are being poached in the Northwest, and like, what are the market demands for them? What are they being used for?
Sure. So there's kind of all sorts of reasons and species that go along with those reasons. If we want to kind of go down the coast, perhaps. So in British Columbia and Washington State, Douglas fir is most often poached. This goes into a variety of cases. So sometimes they might be taken to small mills where they're going to be milled up to it for various uses. So, you know, I think one of the resource officers in British Columbia had said to me once that, you know, that this isn't so much anymore, but there was a real kind of in vogue moment where everyone had like live edge boards. And so sometimes those might be sold direct to buyer off of things like Marketplace, on Facebook and Kijiji and things like that. Often it was being put toward firewood. And I often say that, you know, when the book first came out, there was a certain response to that, which is that a lot of folk didn't quite understand that actually in the West, a lot of us are still using wood to heat our houses. And this is a big market. It's a huge market where I live. And so a lot of it was going toward firewood. And sometimes it was even being exported to be sold as firewood to like bigger city hubs, not even just staying near the communities of where it had been taken down. And then as you go further,
there's not careful regulation or tracking like provenance of where did this tree come from? I mean,
who's going to
backwoods operations, literally.
You know, I feel very careful about judging this because we were just talking about Haida Gwaii, and I bought cords of wood when I was there, and I did not once ask anyone where this wood had come from.
Has this been ethically sourced?
Yeah, or like, hey, which woodlot did you get this from? Like,
because they probably don't know, and the woodlot may not even have careful records of like.
No, and so, you know, I feel guilty about that now, but I mean, if you think about it, who is, you know, and also that's not even to say that all of these kind of smaller operations are doing this, because there's people have been found to be selling wood at Home Depot that has been poached. Right. So like, it's not just on
it works
this.
In the bigger supply chains sometimes too.
That's exactly it.
So moving down the coast, what about like some of the maples or cedars, sequoias?
Exactly. So maple is also in British Columbia, Washington, and a little bit in Oregon. And this I am fascinated by because it's often poached on a bit of a smaller scale, but due to its beauty. And it's often sold to artisans and instrument makers and people that are using it for kind of more aesthetic purposes. And that's because maple has that beautiful flamed grain, maple grain, used in frames, used in violin and guitar faces and flutes. And I, you know, I could just go on and on about the things that, that pens, you know, there's like a real market for these, fancy pens. There is a somewhat famous case of a maple poaching site in, I want to say it was Washington State, and I apologize, I might be wrong, it might be Oregon, of a fellow who had found this sort of beautiful grove of maple in a state forest and was very slowly just taking them down one by one. And when he was finally sort of busted by the natural resource officers, you know, they called it the slaughterhouse because there had been so many maple that were taken out of this one area. And then kind of aligned with that is cedar. So cedar is poached again in the exact same areas and used a lot more for building materials, renovation supplies, things like that. So a lot of my reporting, people would talk about shake block and they would say, you know, this was being poached for shake block. Often that was with cedar, and that's being eventually being used as shingles for your house or siding for your house. Or, you know, if the cedar is big enough and straight enough and you manage to get it down, you know, you might be using it for fence panels or deck material or siding. So that was a common use. And then Northern California has its own sort of interesting, Southern Oregon and Northern California, this interesting kind of local market for redwood burls. And a fair chunk.
Can you explain
of
what a burl is, if for listeners that are not aware?
Yeah, for sure. It's those big, huge bulbs that you'll sometimes see growing off the side of a tree, and they look like they're covered in bark, and they look like big bumps. And for most people, they are small. You know, they might be on a tree in your front yard, and you're thinking, there's just like a little lump. On a redwood, they are absolutely massive. They look like these huge protruding beach balls coming off the side of a tree, or, you know, ideally for a poacher near the bottom of the tree, near where it hits the ground. And they have actually quite beautiful wood on the inside there. It can be very smooth and unknotted. And for redwood in particular, you know, it gives the benefit of having beautiful redwood wood that can be sliced easily into tabletops or spun into bowls, you know, with a lathe, or sometimes just honestly cut up and sold to artisans who are going to make all sorts of or cut up and sold to artisans that might make things like chairs or side tables out of it.
So in like, you know, a 2 to 3 day operation, how much can a poacher stand to earn? Like, what's the economic
It depends
draw
on
here?
The tree. It depends on the tree. So, you know, one of the poachers, well, two of the poachers that I discuss in the book, they poached on a number of levels. And so in Washington state, they were poaching more in the backwoods, in these kind of Forest Service lands that had just actually, like you were talking about, like, you know, you could bid on salvage lots to kind of take some of this wood. They just started taking the wood without bidding. Over 2 days, I mean, they could really haul out a lot of that if they had the right transportation available to them.
What if they're actually cutting down like a big Doug fir or something, or a burl? Yeah. I know these numbers will be different, but like,
yeah, all different. So I'm thinking like,
is it a pretty clear, large profit? Because this is not just risky work in terms of legality, but logging is very dangerous work as well.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's super risky to them.
The payoff?
So the burls, you know, in one instance, and one of the cases that I write about in the book, I think one of the poachers received just under $2,000. A burl is less risky to poach, and that was actually just a one night operation. That was like being dropped off in the woods, hiking in, cutting out a big burl, getting it back to the vehicle, and then trying to find somebody to take it. The larger trees, it's hard to tell because they don't often, we don't often have cases where we know how much the wood sold for. But on a penalty wise, I could tell you that, you know, it could be a fine of $10,000 to $18,000. And that is based a little bit on kind of beyond just the value of the wood. It is based a little bit on damage to the environment. But a lot of that's based off valuation and how much that tree would have gotten the Forest Service had they sold it, right?
So there's money to be made.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. And especially if you're not looking for a huge payout, but like here and there, a nice chunk.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's also relatively, I mean, you and I can talk about how it's hard, but for a lot of people, it's part of a skill that they've learned and it comes a little bit secondhand and they know where to take it. And so the risk is there, of course, often because they're logging at nighttime. But also to an extent, it's like a little bit of like, know it like the back of my hand practice. And so if you know how to do it and you can go out and earn $2,000 in one night.
Yeah. That's hard to walk away from. I mean, this was one of the driving questions in your book. You were puzzled by, you know, when you were out in these forests, you were really taken with the awe and wonder of the majesty of, especially with some of these just huge ones. And you write about how you were puzzled by, like, well, how could someone else who, especially when you say like a local who actually probably has all these seals, how are they not seeing these forests and these trees in the same way? And like, how could they be then tempted to, you know, to damage these areas? And as already mentioned, you know, it's, you decide that it's a lot more than just because they're drug addicts, even though that's how the criminal justice system sometimes and the media would sometimes always talk about the poachers. It was just for drugs. So what are some of the broader socioeconomic contexts that created this environment to make this something people would do? And this we could talk for hours and hours on.
Yeah.
I understand.
No, I mean, I feel like there's kind of two threads to that. And so the first thread is really related to family history and community history. And if we could talk a little bit about the one town that I spent a fair bit of time in, Orrick, California. This is a logging town. It is built up kind of along the highway itself. So the implication being that, you know, it was very easy for folks in logging trucks to access and to get home and to get to work and come back. And there were at one point 9 mills around this town, redwood mills mostly. And these were communities, you know, we can talk about Orrick, but it's so many communities up and down the Pacific Northwest that were kind of built up in the same way of, you know, late 19th century, well, mid to late 19th century boom. Come on out to California. There's wood for days. It's never ending. There's always a job out here. You know, also you can't go any further west. So it was, you know, sometimes you had worked for companies kind of all along or you or your family had, right? And a lot of the folks that grew up in these areas, they had a real expectation, and whether that's fair or not, that logging was their family profession and that they would work at the mill or they would work in the woods and they would do the things that their grandparents did and their uncles did and their parents did. And that disappeared, and it disappeared for a lot of reasons that we could get into, but this kind of leads into the second thread of this kind of community narrative around why that disappeared. And for the contemporary poachers that I was speaking to, they had grown up during the time of the timber wars. Mm-hmm. And so they had, whether they were working or not at that time, they were living in an environment of tension. And they were living in an environment where sometimes their families didn't know if they were going to have a job in a month. Their fathers may have been on strike. They may have gone out to work one day and found their site obstructed by activist measures. And there was a lot of tension at all times of life, not just during working hours, but on the streets, all times of day, around the spotted owl. Mm-hmm. And the Forest Service, and what all of this meant to people's livelihoods and the towns where they had grown up.
Because it did mean, like, staggering unemployment rates.
Yes,
for years and years. So yeah. there are real costs here.
There are, and there's all sorts of things, there's all sorts of ways that people respond to that, right? So some folks might say, listen, every logger was given a payout. That's not necessarily true. Some people will say, oh, there were all sorts of government initiatives that were put into place to kind of help some of the loggers transition out of that work. I have a lot of questions about that, and I have a lot of kind of thoughts around, you know, why somebody may or may not actually take advantage of those initiatives. But really something that came out of that was a pretty intense dislike of the federal government, which may have already been there, but had been really deepened by feeling betrayed by these federal agencies. So not just the Forest Service, but the National Park Service. You know, I think in Northern California in particular, I write about how some Congress people had traveled out to, maybe it was senators, anyway, had traveled out there, and they had held these community meetings when they were really talking about setting up Redwoods National Park. And people had shown up and given their testimony and talked all about, you know, what had kind of befallen their communities and what a national park might mean for the economies of a lot of families and communities. And that was all recorded and put into a nice little report and then ignored. And so there's kind of all these layers. And so when I was interviewing poachers and they'd say to me that their motivations were, A, I have no other way to make money, and so I have to do this. And I know how, because my dad taught me how to use a chainsaw when I was like 8 or whatever. And B, I want to get back at the Park Service. I hate them. I don't like the rangers. And I see this land as my land, and I'm going to go take what I'm owed. That's how those two kind of braided together.
I mean, in so many ways, this is like such a Western story, because you could take, if you strip away some of the specific details, you could take these dynamics and you can see them playing out amongst ranchers, miners, yep. I mean, all kinds of people who are involved in, you know, extractive industries that,
yes,
you know, depend on leases on public lands and so forth.
Yes.
But also this dynamic, especially say with the National Park Service, where these resources that have been generational family, you know, livelihoods are now going to be set aside and protected, not for the benefit of them, the locals, but for the benefit of tourists from who knows where.
Exactly.
Who have the money to come out and travel and they want to see. It's
yes.
There's just this huge disconnect. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also, unfortunately, there has been a lot of, when you read back kind of through the record of that time, a lot of the implication to the community was that this tourism was going to replace the logging. And that's just impossible. I think actually we're really understanding this now, you know, that the service industry cannot compete with good quote unquote, and I recognize that these were not good for the environment, but like good union, stable jobs. The service industry, you know, there was this promise that tourism is going to come in, and instead of logging, you'll run a B&B or you'll run a tour company or you'll work wherever and it'll be okay. And it just can't. It just cannot replace that.
Wage labor at a McDonald's.
Yep.
And that's not, a whole community can't live off that.
No. And there's all sorts of emotional questions that go along with that, with things like pride and narratives of, you know, who does what and why and what hard work is. And, you know, that is also a very Western, like trait or discussion point.
Yeah. No, it's definitely,
and we could get into
the rugged
also,
individual,
like,
you know, like
masculinity,
that's part of, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And what are service jobs, if not, you know, a little bit softer in implication. So,
yeah. I mean, we had here at the Red Center, I don't remember how many years ago it was, we brought in Joseph Taylor. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a historian at Simon Fraser, but he's giving a talk about the in-lieu payments that the federal government makes to, and he's talking about like the suicide epidemics in some of these regions where there's, you know, it's like if these are family traditions and part of identity, and suddenly it's taken away. Like,
yes.
The psychological, it's not just economic impacts, it's psychological, it's cultural.
Yes.
A lot.
It's hugely cultural. I mean, and that's what motivated me or interested me as I went along, because, and also, you know, we were talking about me being from the prairies and like not really liking it there when I was younger, but then coming back. And I mean, this was something that I came up against in a different context, right? With ranching families and cultural things that were not technically part of my family and which I didn't understand. And now I'm kind of, through this book, in a weird way, understanding things a little bit more, even though it's not a logging community. But anyway,
it makes me think of, I think that, you know, in public discourse, a lot of why we're so dysfunctional is because we don't have empathy. We haven't built empathy for other people's, but also we don't seem to have much interest in building empathy.
Yep.
And it seems that a lot of these competing priorities, all this tension, and I should say we probably are running out of time because I think you do have other things to do today. Are there key perspectives that we should be thinking about, like broadly in the West, to better understand, you know, the other side of these issues? Like, what is it that some people don't understand about poachers? What is it that poachers don't understand about the land managers? Like, what are ways in which we're just talking past each other, and how can we connect?
So part of that, I think, is the structure of the federal government staffing, which I have like a real interest in now, oddly.
That's a real niche geek interest.
It's a real niche thing. But I will say that every poacher at one point or another said to me, I don't know these people. They don't know me. They didn't grow up here. And that's true. A lot of like Redwoods is, due to it being a beautiful park, it's like a high in demand place to get moved to. So sometimes you have rangers that are coming there who are from Pennsylvania or who worked previously at Shenandoah. And like, that is amazing. But that's like, that puts off a lot of locals because they're like, you don't understand this community. You didn't grow up here.
But are the locals not filling in some of the lower level?
No.
No. Positions in state and local parks or Forest Service?
I'm sure they are, but like, you know, the folks that I was talking to, they were not applying for those jobs. You know, I think there was one fella who is a poacher who was very upset that, you know, he said when he was 18, he had applied for a job at the park and didn't even get interviewed, and that this had really sort of launched, I could tell that this had launched itself within him, you know. And I'm sure there are reasons, like, you know, you can't hire everybody from a town. I understand that. But I do think that the sort of shuffling that often takes place in federal departments is counter to what might actually help with goodwill.
Also hinders like the building of relationships. Like you were saying, you had to build relationships with these people for oral histories. If there's going to be good community dialogue between, say, rangers and townspeople, those are relationships that might take years to build. And if people are being shuffled in and out from, especially from outside, that that just is going to deepen the suspicion of one group with the other, right?
Exactly. And you also have to, and again, this is going to sound like I'm really negative about the Rangers, but it's not that it's the system. I just want to make that very clear. I do think there's a certain patronizing method there of like, we're going to decide what's best for this park and this land, and then we will
know
tell
best.
You.
Yeah. And the locals who live there on the land. I mean, again, this is so Western. This is all over, especially in the rural West.
Exactly.
This exact same thing is unfolding everywhere.
Yeah. And so, and, you know, I think that this is illustrated very well with a recent project that's been going on in Redwoods. It's called Redwoods Rising. It's funded by the federal government and Save the Redwoods League and kind of some other associations. And part of this is a recognition that actually logging does need to take place on conservation lands. And I cannot tell you the number of people from this nearby community who angrily told me, and now they're logging it. After all of that, now they're logging it, and they're not hiring me to take down the trees. They're bringing in expensive contractors from wherever. And, you know, we said 30 years ago that, like, you need to do selective thinning and you need to do all of this for fire prevention. They didn't listen, and now they're logging it anyway. And that is hard to disagree with. That is, you know, and not only that, I think they see these levels of organizations and they get really frustrated by it. They're thinking, whether it's true or not, like, why does Save the Redwoods League now get to partake in this activity that we were demonized for by them?
Yeah.
You know, like, that's really, that's rough PR.
It seems to confirm all of the worst suspicions they already had.
It does.
Right.
It does. And actually, we don't have a ton of time, but anyway, actually, it does also feed into this broader concern in the world about conspiracy theories and trust of government and anti-establishment thinking, because this is a place where a lot of people would disagree with me and my points of view if we ever dug into them that much. But it really feeds into the misinformation problem. For sure.
Well, I think this is also, I mean, before we started recording, you were saying, no, this is a kind of a Pacific Northwest story. Is that Western enough? And, like, yes, this just resonates with so many headlines from across, you know, the entire region.
It's a little bit depressing, but I also think that I'm lucky for the opportunity to kind of understand it a bit better. And, you know, my points of view were not changed on this issue in particular. They were just broadened. And I think that that is helpful.
But you also understand their point of view, even if you don't agree with it. Like, that's empathy, right? And I think that's what I think your book, especially as your book is really filled with people's stories.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Individuals that we trace, like, you do start to understand them, even if you still disagree with them. Like, I think that's one of the big things that's missing. Do you want to take a moment in closing to tell us about anything that you're working on now or what we might see from you in the future?
Yeah, I've been really, so the final chapters of Tree Thieves talk a little bit about community forest management. And that's because I live in an area where there's a community forest, and I'm really interested in how they've developed it so that, because this is a former logging community that I live in, and you know, it has had to take a turn toward tourism for better and for worse. And so, you know, I'm really interested in conservation outside of sort of the government method, I guess. And so actually part of that is looking at different sort of land reform laws, and a pet interest of mine, or not a pet interest, but an equal interest of mine to poaching randomly, is Scottish history. I got my master's in Scotland, and I learned about oral history there, and they have this very interesting Land Reform Act that allows communities to buy back, or in some cases forces landlords to surrender land that was once community run, managed, like way back in history. And so what you have right now happening is quite a few people or quite a few communities buying back things like entire islands from private landlords and running it for community use and having community energy projects and grazing spaces for livestock and farms and stuff. So I'm pursuing that a little bit more. And I'm also digging a little bit into the history. This is, again, totally out there. And like, I'm sure every academic who listens to this, because I'm not a traditional academic, they're like, what is her path? Anyway, but I'm also really interested in Carl Schenck, the German forester who was the second, who's brought over to help develop the forestry program at the Biltmore Estate, and was worked alongside Gifford Pinchot at the Forest Service briefly. So I have a few things going on.
Well, I can tie threads between them. I see the
sure. Thanks.
Well, yeah. This has been so great, and congrats on the book. I know it's received some very positive press, and I'm really excited to see what else you come out with in these other projects. So thanks for spending some time with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, take care, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you'll subscribe and listen every month. Please leave us a review on whatever app or platform you're listening through, or follow us on Facebook at Writing Westward Podcast, or on Twitter at Writing West, where you can get updates and leave comments. Writing Westward is a production of the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at Brigham Young University. We're an interdisciplinary research center that supports academic research and the promotion of public understandings about the North American West. We host regular public lectures, which we live stream, have an annual funding cycle with award, grant, and fellowship categories that nearly anyone researching or working on the region from any disciplinary approach or towards any final product can apply. Learn more at redcenter.byu.edu. That's R-E-D-D Center. Our theme music was provided by local Utah composer Micah Dahl Anderson. Find him at Micah, D-A-H-L, Dahl, Anderson, with an O, .com. I'll put a link in the episode description. My name is Brendan Rensink. I serve as the podcast host, producer, and just about everything else, so you can direct any praise or critique my way. I'm author and editor of a number of books on the West, borderlands, Native peoples, genocide studies, religion, and the environment. Recently, my book, Native But Foreign, Indigenous Immigrants and Refugees in the North American Borderlands, published by Texas A&M University Press in 2018, won the Best Historical Nonfiction Book Award from the Western Writers of America. In an anthology I co-edited with P. Jane Hafen, entitled Essays on American Indian and Mormon History, published by the University of Utah Press in 2019, won the Metcalf Best Anthology Book Prize from the John Whitmer Historical Association. Here at the Redd Center, I'm also general editor and project manager of a great digital history, public history project named Intermountain Histories. It's a free mobile app and website, intermountainhistories.org, that curates student-researched and written microhistories of the region, complete with archival photos, bibliographies, and more. To contact me about the podcast, my own research, or anything else, head to bwrensink, that's R-E-N-S-I-N-K.org, or follow me on Twitter at Brendan W. Rensink. Until next month, be well, be curious, and be kind. Cheers.